It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In 1917, federal prosecutors went after one of the largest unions in the country, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, the so-called Wobblies. Why? Well, the union had vehemently opposed America's entry into World War I. Fueled by the Espionage Act of 1917 and using the newly formed Bureau of Investigation, they conducted massive raids on IWW offices around the country and arrested thousands of union members. The Chicago trial became one of the largest show trials ever held outside of Stalin's Russia. Are there parallels between how the government dealt with dissent in 1917 and what we see today? Well, that's one of the questions we'll be asking over the next hour. What do you think about the way the government responds to perceived threats? What about what happened after the 9/11 attacks? Do you agree with the way the government monitors people now? Is your privacy threatened? What issues do you have with the way the FBI wields its power today? What should and shouldn't be the role of federal investigators? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Dean Strang is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and an adjunct professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. His book is called Keep the Wretches in Order. Dean, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
Let's talk about the industrial workers of the world, or the Wobblies as they were known. Who are they, and are they the wretches you mention in your book?
They were the wretches that an assistant attorney general who was in charge of shaping the prosecution in 1917 and 1918 described in a letter to a U.S. senator that summer, and I drew the title of the book from his words. The IWW was a really very innovative union founded in 1905 in Chicago and always based in Chicago. It still exists. It's no longer a large force in American labor, but it's still very much a presence. And the basic innovation of the industrial workers of the world was or arose from looking out at the labor movement at the time and saying, you know, all workers are divided among craft groups and trade groups, and we're all sort of fighting over the same nickel from employers. And what we ought to do is recognize that one is either a worker or not. One is either a worker or a capitalist in the argot of the day. And if you're a worker, let's organize you not by your particular skill, but by the industrial sector within which you work. So if you work in marine transport, you have a community of interest with everybody else, whether they're a longshoreman or they're a merchant marine or, you know, whatever it is. And that was the idea that sort of undergirded this union. And the aspiration consistent with that basic idea was that men and women would stand shoulder to shoulder and be members of the same union, that people of all races, ethnicities, that immigrants would be welcome, that one was a worker and a worker was a worker was a worker, and the workers of the world had nothing in common. I'm paraphrasing or nearly quoting verbatim there the preamble to the IWW Constitution, nothing in common with capital or with employers.
Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Was that the slogan?
I don't know that came out of the IWW, but they certainly would have endorsed that.
Before we dig into the way the federal government used to respond to uprisings and imminent threats, which was the pretext for what was done to the Wobblies, I want to understand, how does the federal government currently respond to these types of perceived threats? What are we seeing today?
Well, an important thesis of my book is that ordinarily, at least on domestic soil, the federal government responds through the Justice Department, not through the Department of Defense, not through the Labor Department, And this trial, actually, the Chicago trial was the largest and first, but one of four trials overall back in 1917 and 1918. This trial marked the critical turning point at which we Americans began to look to lawyers, essentially, and law enforcement agents under the aegis of the Department of Justice and therefore as part of the federal government for a response to domestic threats of violence or disruption rather than looking to state and local governments and sort of ad hoc quasi-military responses. Until this trial, really serious labor disruptions or other, you know, perceived threats from the extreme edges of the ideological spectrum really were dealt with in a quasi-military fashion. Call out the militia, deputize company strike breakers as, you know, as deputies. If the sheriff or the mayor or whoever was sympathetic to employers, as they usually were. We sort of take for granted now that the Justice Department is the first responder, if you will, to domestic threats. It was not always so.
Let's take a call from Nancy in Wausau. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning. I couldn't help but think the minute you mentioned the Wobblies that has not always been government's idea of keeping the people in line. Because coming from Wisconsin, is that not what Scott Walker tried to do with bashing the unions and taking away their power, and that way silencing them as well as their vote, and just really disrupting the voice of the people?
Nancy, thanks for the call. Dean Strang?
Yeah, Nancy, let's back up just a moment to bring other people along, because I hadn't mentioned that the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW, also referred to themselves as Wobblies. It was an accidental nickname, but they took it on as a badge of pride and referred to one another as Wobbs or Wobblies or IWWs. And then the broader point you make is, yeah, I think there is a through line in the course of American history with employers and politicians in their thrall seeking ways to, in effect, organize against labor. And that's true today. It's in many ways as true today as it was in 1917. The tactics are different. Oftentimes, the framework, of course, is a little bit different, but when you see the efforts in 2011, for example, with Act 10, led by Scott Walker, then governor, to tamp down on public unions, public sector unions, to restrict the range of points on which they may bargain, what you're seeing is an effort spurred by employers or capital to use government to limit the range of activities on which employees might organize and act collectively, and to impede those efforts at collective action in very strategic ways.
Dean Strang is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and an adjunct professor at the University of Virginia Law School. His book is called Keep the Wretches in Order. Our conversation continues in a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In 1917, amid fears of a labor strike during World War I, the Department of Justice targeted union workers affiliated with the Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, in what would become one of the biggest mass trials in U.S. history. The IWW had come out very strongly against America's entry into World War I, The result, our guest says, changed the way the country handles threats from dissenters. We're learning how this historical turning point affects us today. What do you think about the way the government responds to threats? What about what happened after the 9/11 attacks? Do you agree with the way the government monitors people now? Do you feel your privacy is being threatened? What issues do you have with the way the FBI wields its power today? What should and shouldn't be the role of federal investigators in investigating dissent? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Dean Strang is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and an adjunct professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. His book is called Keep the Wretches in Order. Dean, your book is centered on how the federal government replaced gunmen with lawyers and morgues with prisons. On the surface, that may seem like a good switch, but where do you see the problems?
Well, I want to be clear that overall, I see it as a drift or at least a shift into the right direction. To the extent that we're not shooting striking workers, but rather considering at least legalistic tactics, that's at least a shade toward in the right direction. But what we have now is a Justice Department that is vastly larger and more capable of intruding into dissenting thought and movements than we did back in 1917, of course. And the events of 1917 and 18, I think, put us on a different trajectory. But we have a department now with 115,000 employees. We have an FBI, which is a quasi-independent agency, at least on an org chart, you know, under the umbrella of the Justice Department, but with a good deal of autonomy. Back in 1917, it was really a very small bureau within the Justice Department itself. So the powers have been accreted and expanded. And, you know, when you're talking about 115,000 investigators and lawyers with the power to use the authority of the government to lock you up, potentially, you always have to be worried about overreaching with that power, especially when you get into political ideology. And the FBI and the Justice Department itself, certainly in the last 75 years, has been fairly aggressive in monitoring, policing, and prosecuting those both on the left edge of American politics and on the right edge of American politics.
Well, in fact, one of the arguments you make in your book is that the Department of Justice has engaged and perhaps continues to engage in prosecutorial overreach. Can you walk us through some examples of this overreach?
Well, there's the mundane sort of everyday that goes without notice unless you happen to be working in the federal criminal justice system. The, you know, charging 20 counts against somebody when one or two would do, aggressive use of conspiracy theory to net really very minor players or, you know, potential fringe players in criminal conduct. Overcharging in the sense of charging mandatory minimum sentences that really are unjust in application. But, you know, beyond that, better known examples would be the harassment of and imprisonment of members of the American Communist Party in the 40s, 50s, even into the 60s. The Julius and Ethel Rosenberg prosecution, I think, is a particularly low point for the Justice Department and for the federal courts that enabled it. It's really hard to avoid the conclusion in that particular case that Ethel Rosenberg was used simply as a pawn or a cat's paw to try to convince her husband, Julius, to plead guilty or to reveal the full scope of his espionage. And when Julius didn't buckle, the government, you know, felt it would lose face if it backed down, and Ethel went to her death in the electric chair, too.
We have a caller on the line. Ray is with us from Milwaukee. Ray, welcome to the morning show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just kind of stunned at how the American public is just laid down and let big tech, in concert with the government, literally, we have smart speakers in our homes that are listening to every single conversation. We have smartphones that are tracking every single move. Now, the Europeans are starting to crack down on big tech and especially privacy concerns, but we seem to be asleep in this country. And I'm talking to you right now on a flip phone, no GPS, no tracking. And I really am thinking about going back to a landline. But every time I hear, for instance, this station do a commercial for a smart speaker, I'm like, would people 50 years ago have agreed to this? And since George W. Bush admitted after 9/11, grudgingly, that yes, we're listening to all phone calls, everything. It doesn't matter if you're calling overseas or whatever. We're listening to everything. Why aren't we in the streets protesting this?
Okay, Ray, we get it. Dean Strang, a lot more surveillance capability the federal government has in its hands right now. How does that play into the culture that you talk about having developed in the Department of Justice after World War I?
Well, it's dangerous. The basic government impulse is revealed 100 years ago in the trials I explore, but our technological capacity to act on or fulfill those impulses is vastly greater today, as Ray rightly points out. And the fact of the matter is that Americans often, this isn't new, but it remains true today, Americans often are willing to swap security for their freedom or their privacy. And I think they often view that as exactly the exchange. I don't think that's rightly what the exchange is or ought to be. You know, giving up your privacy doesn't necessarily increase your security. But B, you know, if we're to remain a free people, the fact of the matter is you need to be a bit brave and you need to assert the importance of your privacy and not buckle under to those who commonly say, look, if I'm not doing anything wrong, why should it matter if somebody's listening, including the government? Well, that's not the point. The point is that when government impinges on our private sphere, we are all cowed at a level in the sort of opinions we're willing to voice and the things we're ultimately willing to think.
Let's look at Timothy McVeigh. He was charged for his role in the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, a horrific event. A truck exploded in front of a federal building. More than 160 people died, sparking outrage across the country and a great deal of fear. McVeigh received the death penalty, but you point to McVeigh's case as prosecutorial overreach. Why?
Apart from one's view of the death penalty, and I oppose it, but, you know, people of intelligence and good faith oppose me on that and support the death penalty. So setting aside the penalty exacted there, I thought the most significant point of overreach in that case was the government reaching out to the innocent younger sister, a woman in her 20s at that time, of Timothy McVeigh, and unwillingly making her an instrument of her brother's death by compelling her to testify against him in the penalty phase of that trial for the specific purpose of trying to persuade a jury to impose death rather than a sentence of life without parole. Jennifer McVeigh, I think, did not want to be an implement of her brother's death, much as she hated what he had done and was appalled by it. But that was a government that was willing to force a sister into the role of helping advance the cause of her own brother's death you know, and that seems to me really an abandoned, an immoral approach for the government that ought to worry anyone, regardless of our understandable and rightful horror at the act that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols committed.
Dean Strang is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and an adjunct professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. His book is titled Keep the Wretches in Order. We have news coming up next, and then we'll have more of our discussion about how the federal government handles dissent, including why the Wobblies became such a target for federal prosecution back in 1917, and how the Espionage Act changed the way the Department of Justice handles these matters. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're exploring a case that's a century old, one that still echoes today. What do you think about the way the government responds to dissent or to perceived threats to order? What should and shouldn't be the role of federal government here? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Tell us where you see the line between justice and abuse of power. Dean Strang is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and an adjunct professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. He's written a book titled Keep the Wretches in Order. Dean, let's get back to the industrial workers of the world. Why is it that they became such a target for the federal government in 1917?
Well, they were a rapidly growing union once war broke out in Europe. Their numbers were probably in the 20,000 range in the U.S. in 1914, but by 1917, you had 70,000 or more workers who were card-carrying members of the IWW. And from the perspective of Western business interests and Western politicians especially, the IWW was strong in precisely the industries that were most essential to mounting a rapid war effort once Congress acceded to President Wilson's request that it declare war in April 1917. So we're 3 years late to the war. The government is trying to spool up very rapidly to send troops abroad and to produce the munitions and clothing and everything else needed to support the war effort. And all of the industries essential to that were the very industries in which the IWW was very strong. So logging in the Pacific Northwest, mining of lead, copper, you know, the essentials of munitions throughout the West, mining on the Mesabi Range in northern Minnesota, right across from you, John, where we're getting iron ore, again, also essential. The shipping docks on the East Coast were the point of departure for troops and supplies and munitions. Cotton and textiles, you know, cotton being grown in the South, an area of strength, migrant farm workers, migrant farm labor was an IWW strong area, and then textile production in the Northeast, also an IWW stronghold. So, you know, as industrial interests and politicians looked out across the country, they thought if the IWW calls a general strike or otherwise, a wildcat walkout here and there, they could shut down production and seriously hamper the war effort. And that's really why, again, especially coming from the West, the perception of employers and politicians was that local action just isn't going to be effective here. We need a coordinated national response. And they looked to Washington and to the federal government. It really was a remarkable shift in how the country tried to address perceived threats from large masses of people who, as you pointed out, many of whom at least opposed the war. It's worth noting that the IWW leadership itself, the General Executive Board, didn't take a position on the war, but it also thought it didn't have to because so many of the members were of the view that, you know, this was decaying monarchies on the European continent fighting each other for essentially mercenary or financial interests, and that working boys, wherever they might be, were being pressed into slaughtering one another to serve the interests of the wealthy.
So I'm listening to this, and I'm not a legal expert. I don't play one on the radio. I'm still listening for something that sounds like a crime here. What exactly was the IWW's perceived criminal activity that the government decided to use this massive prosecution for?
2 months after Congress declared war and we joined World War I, in June 1917, Congress enacted the Espionage Act. Still around is the Espionage Act of 1917, although it's been amended. Both parts of it have been removed and other new provisions have been added. And the Espionage Act was the basic framework for this prosecution. Much of the Espionage Act covers what we would typically think of as espionage, taking government documents or plans or, you know, blueprints, handing them over to hostile foreign powers. But the act at the time in 1917 also prohibited any conduct that might produce insubordination, disloyalty, or interfere with the effort to recruit troops. And any conspiracy to do that also was made expressly illegal. And so the five conspiracy counts that the government mounted against 166 IWW members in Chicago were all rooted in that idea that promoting disloyalty was itself a crime.
And that sounds like some sort of violation of the First Amendment. And I don't want to get too far afield here, but was that actually tested in court?
You're not at all afield, and it wasn't tested. And I addressed I tried to give an answer to why, you know, we didn't hear more talk about the First Amendment in that trial and in the appeal that followed. There's a spoiler. And the reason was that although the text of the First Amendment and our freedom of speech never has changed in 228 years, it's been the same since 1791, the fact of the matter is that until the 1930s, and really more robustly until the 1960s, speech that had a mere tendency to cause public disorder or to invite lawbreaking, however trivial that lawbreaking might be, could be prosecuted and punished. And not just the Wobblies, but any number of radicals and pacifists and opponents of World War I went to prison in the United States in the late teens and the 1920s, and they mostly stayed there. It was the 1930s before the U.S. Supreme Court first reversed a criminal conviction on First Amendment free speech grounds.
Let's take a call. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi. I have a general question. Well, not a general question, but I want to relate this, too, to some things that have happened currently. But back before World War I, the general population of the United States was pacifist. They were against going into war. Wilson even had a hire Edward Bernays, Freud's nephew, to start a marketing plan to convince people we had to go to war. So the 70,000 Wobblies, I think maybe the only danger they presented to the FBI was their organizing ability. But, you know, just recently I wanted to also include this. There's the environmental movement. Some people in Minnesota were arrested, a group of people. They were arrested, thrown in jail. All their computers were confiscated. And then all charges were dismissed, but the FBI kept their computers. And maybe to contact all of their contacts and keep those people on file as well. I think they're still pretty damn aggressive. And Mueller, the guy that was conducting the Russian tapes, he lied to get us into Iraq war, and I think he was with the FBI at the time.
Okay, so to the point that the caller was making, it wasn't just the Wobblies who were against going into war. There was quite a bit of anti-war sentiment prior to the declaration of war. So
and after John. And,
okay,
and it's sort of hard to realize it today, but much of that opposition to America's entry to the war was in rural areas, was on farms. And it was, you know, it was very practical at some level in both the U.S. and Canada. Farming was still very labor intensive back then, and a large sector of the American workforce was employed in agriculture. And if you plucked young men off the farms and sent them abroad in uniform, who was going to plant? Who was going to cultivate? Who was going to harvest the crops? So there was real anti-war sentiment in a sense then, in a much less globally connected world, that European problems were European problems, not North American problems.
This was the largest criminal trial attempted by any American civilian court. You had presided over by Judge Landis, who later went on to be the commissioner of baseball and was known as Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Why is this trial so significant?
Well, it is by a factor of three or more the largest mass trial ever attempted to this day in civilian courts in the United States. 166 people named in one indictment, 112 present in court by the end of the first day of jury selection, 97 still left on trial 4.5 months later when the case wrapped up and went to the jury. You know, today a trial of 20 is enormous. And so this one really dwarfs every other trial that any American civilian court has attempted. The only thing that even comes remotely close was a prosecution out in Cheyenne, Wyoming, in federal court during World War II of Japanese internees American citizens of Japanese ancestry who were interned in the Heart Mountain Camp in Wyoming on suspicion of disloyalty because of their ancestry and ethnicity. And then the government drafted the young men in the camp, and a number of them resisted the draft, and 40-something of them were prosecuted en masse, too. But this really was far and away the largest mass trial ever.
We'll continue our conversation with Dean Strang in just a moment. His book is Keep the Wretches in Order, America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department and Fall of the IWW. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The mass prosecution of union workers and organizers in 1917 and 1918 was a turning point in the development of what became our federal Justice Department. As our conversation continues, we'll talk about what happened after the trials and the impact these events have had on how the federal government handles dissent. Listeners, are you aware that the Espionage Act is still in effect and is being used today? What do you think about the way the government uses the law to respond to threats? What issues do you have with the way power is wielded in these cases? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to the phones, and Bernie is with us in Elkhorn. Bernie, good morning. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, and thank you both for a wonderful show. Yes, the Espionage Act, it's interesting that it's been being used to persecute Julian Assange as a publisher of information that is important for people in this democracy to know about what their government's up to. But it's being used to try to extradite illegally this non-U.S. citizen for simply publishing information, and he's been smeared in the press from Fox to NPR as being a hacker, when all he's done is publish. And it's interesting that that Espionage Act is still around, and it's completely unconstitutional, unless, you know, we were talking about real espionage.
Bernie, thanks for that call. Dean, we alluded to this some of this earlier. The constitutional issues around the Espionage Act have never really been fully explored, have they? And what about what Bernie had to say there?
There's much Bernie says with which I agree. First, let's just sort of break it down. First, the Espionage Act of 1917 still is around. As I say, it's been amended. Parts of it have been trimmed away, and some of the most overbroad or problematic from the First Amendment standpoint have been, eliminated. But other parts of it have been expanded. And Bernie's underlying point is worth underscoring, which is the Julian Assange prosecution is an example consistent with many in the past of the American tendency not to punish those who commit the war crime or the illegal act within government ranks, but to punish those who disclose it, who reveal the war crime to the world. And that rightly should trouble all of us. That said, I'm not intimately familiar with the prosecution theory in Julian Assange's case, but the idea of taking government documents that might be useful to a foreign adversary and publishing them or disclosing them, fits within the basic framework, or can fit within the basic framework of espionage, of stealing government secrets to harm the interests of the United States and aid a foreign adversary. Now, there are real questions about whether we ought to prosecute people who simply make public the misdeeds of public officials, of those acting in the name of the citizens of the United States. And I don't know that it is clear that Julian Assange, for example, meant to aid a foreign government or to harm the legitimate interests of the United States. I don't know. And I don't think any of us are in a position to prejudge that. But the underlying point that Bernie makes is a legitimate one.
The Espionage Act itself seemed to give prosecutors new tools that they had not had before, particularly when it comes to things that could be seized under search warrants and things like that. That was a huge turning point legally in this country, wasn't it?
Yes, it's a good point, John. I mean, you've extracted something really quite specific and good from the book. And until the Espionage Act of 1917, believe it or not, it was generally illegal, improper to use a search warrant to gather mere evidence. You could use a search warrant to recover the fruits of a crime or contraband, things that were legal in themselves. But you couldn't use a search warrant just to go nosing around for evidence that might help you prove the crime. The Espionage Act specifically by statute changed that and allowed the issuance of search warrants for anything that might have evidentiary value in proving a crime rather than being the fruit of the crime itself.
Why do we just to kind of tie a bow on the end of the Wobbly saga there, the trial went forward, dozens of people were put in prison, but then many of them received clemency, if not full pardons. Not everybody was happy with that. What eventually happened with those who were involved in this mass trial in Chicago?
Well, they all were convicted. Again, a spoiler, but they all were convicted by the jury, those 97 who remained. Most of them, that is all but under five of them, got a prison term from Judge Landis, who really was a harsh sentencer and took a very dim view of the Wobblies. Those who were in prison long enough, you're quite right, had their sentences commuted eventually by President Harding, who ran for office in 1920 on a theme of returning to normalcy. And one, I think, you know, really part of the interesting coda in this book is the way in which executive clemency was used by a man not remembered as a great U.S. president, but who responded to a growing recognition at the time that there were excesses in wartime, and that while some of these prosecutions in the minds of many then might have been justified during war, once the war was over, you had to relax. You know, the restrictions. You had to recognize that these were, in a sense, political prisoners. And indeed, they were described as political prisoners by Republicans, by Democrats, by public office holders, by people who are not wild-eyed radicals. They were recognized as political prisoners. So initially, the Harding administration tried to attach conditions to a commutation, you know, renounce your radical activities, apologize, promise not to be involved in the labor movement anymore. And when many of the IWWs weren't takers for that, said, no, we'll sit in prison rather than renouncing our principles. Eventually, the Harding administration relented and simply released them.
Dean, you received national attention after the Netflix docuseries Making a Murderer shone a light on your role in the Stephen Avery case. How have you used that platform to bring attention to causes you care about, like this one?
Well, I've tried to do the same thing I'm trying to do in the book, which at bottom is to invite people to recognize the inhumanities that we inflict on one another through the criminal justice system. And the fact that the criminal justice system itself reflects all of the frailties and possibilities of human beings, that this is a very human enterprise, and we ought to recognize it as such for both the good and the bad. A lot of the men who went to prison here in this case 100 years ago had done nothing wrong, nothing more than express an unpopular opinion, certainly. And, you know, they were treated inhumanely. They were treated as simple instruments of a felt pressure on the government at the time. We do that still today, and the pressures are different, the motivations are different, but the effects are the same.
And I think that's a good place for us to end our discussion. Dean Strang, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about this very important topic this morning.
It was really delightful. Thank you for asking me.
Dean Strang is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and an adjunct professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. His book is called Keep the Wretches in Order, America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department, and the Fall of the IWW. Just ahead, we get an update on Foxconn. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.